Alegria versus Williams and others, and we'll hear from Mr. Griffin.
If it may please this court, Justice O'Connor, my name is Anthony Griffin. I'm a lawyer out of Galveston, Texas, and I have the pleasure of representing Dana Alegria, who is the appellant. And in 1999, out of the state district court in Galveston, she was put on probation, or community supervision is properly called now. Her probation was for 10 years, and she had a number of different community supervision officers during the course of that probation. Her probation was for, it was a drug offense that she was put on probation for. In 2005, she changed community supervision officers, and she was assigned a gentleman by the name of Larry Williams. And from the time that Larry Williams became her community supervision officer, he began the process of making comments, touching, suggestions, innuendos, and harassing her on a regular basis. Ms. Alegria was on extensive supervision, which required her to report more regularly than the ordinary probationer, and she submitted an affidavit that's part of the record on appeal, as well as her deposition was taken in this matter. Her affidavit is found at 410 to 413 in the record on appeal, clerk's record on appeal. The touching and the comments started before she was probationer. Mr. Williams, when seeing her in the waiting room in Galveston, Texas, made a comment inquiring when will she get off probation, because he sure would like to hit that. She understood that was a suggestive comment, and she did not know that ultimately she would be under his supervision. At some point in time in the end of 2005, Mr. Williams carried his assault on Dana Alegria to a different level, and he touched her, followed her into the elevator, and he assaulted her in the elevator. She left, and she said in her affidavit as well as her deposition that she started to avoid. She tried to get out of there as much as she could. Every time she would go see him, she would make excuses. She did everything she could to avoid him, and this time he decided to corner her in the elevator. She then went to a friend of hers who was a police officer in Galveston, and he then suggested going to the Galveston County District Attorney's Office, which she did. And they wired her for both sound and video, and Mr. Williams, true to his nature, cornered her and pulled her in the stairwell of the office of this building on the fourth or fifth floor, and assaulted her on video and audio. Unbeknownst to Ms. Alegria, there was additional facts that she did not know, and those facts were that a judge and state district judge in Galveston, Texas, Judge Susan Criss, was complaining mightily in the community supervision board, which consists of both state district court judges and county court judges, and she was complaining mightily about the conduct in the probation department, in the community supervision department. She raised concerns that that the office was out of control, and she expressed concern that they had officers who were touching staff members at the court, who were making comments to staff members at the court, who were getting arrested for sexual offenses. One officer was arrested for sexual offenses, and she brought this to the head of the department, Mr. Kelly's, attention. And the record is replete with, as she brought it to Mr. Kelly's attention, Mr. Kelly fought the judges off and said, "Stay out of my business," and he would do it. He just wouldn't take any type of proactive action on this matter. Also, unbeknownst to Mrs. Alegria, 3 years before her assault, this same probation or community supervision officer had assaulted a woman by the name of Alanice. And that Mrs. Alanice, when her probation officer changed from male to female, began to cry. The female officer asked her why she's crying. She said she was happy that she now has a female officer. And she said, "Well, what's wrong?" And she told them about Mr. Williams' conduct toward her. The record is in dispute at this point. because what the state says in their responsive writings to the district court and their responsive writings to this court is that what we in fact did is we went to her and says, report this to the IG's office so they can investigate. Mrs. Alanise says that she reported it to them. A supervisor by the name of Sanchez came in. She agreed to cooperate. She heard nothing back from them. She went to the district attorney's office on her own. They asked her whether she would be willing to be wired. She said yes, and no one got back with her. So the record is in dispute. And what the issue before this court, and we set it out on page 28 of our brief, is that the Supreme Court has not answered, and I think that there is some language in the court's decisions on this issue, is that the Supreme Court has not answered, left unanswered, whether knowledge of other individuals have been subjected to harassment is sufficient to support liability.
So you don't want to rely today on what the state did in response to your client's complaint? They did get rid of Williams, didn't they?
They did get rid of Williams.
The response was pretty good. But are you telling us, in effect, that you don't want us to look at that? You want us to look at what happened with respect to another woman?
No. I think the court has to contextually look at what happened in my case also, in these facts also.
Well, was the response in your client's case adequate Title IX case?
I think the response in my client's case was inadequate in a sense that we have a case of deliberate blindness. Now, I recognize the court has consistently used the words deliberate indifference.
Yes.
What this case is about is that literally we have a deliberate blindness to what is going on in this department, around this department, where you have judicial officers saying, what are you doing? Protect these probationers.
Am I wrong that in response to your client's complaint, they got rid of the offender, Mr. Williams?
You're not wrong on that. But what the court can ignore is that the acts that before Mr. Williams being terminated, that this would not have occurred if there was not deliberate blindness to what was going on in this department. That all of a sudden, when my client files her complaint and goes to the district attorney's office and it shows up in the paper, they go looking for Alanise. And that's admitted in the record. After they find Alanise, they pen a letter in 2006 documenting that Alanise came in 3 years before, and then they write in the letter, oh, we forgot to tell you, Mr. Kelly. Even though the person who came into the room with Mrs. Alanise was a supervisor for the department who signed off on Mr. Williams' vacation request. So what I'm essentially arguing to the court is I recognize that the decision under Title IX generally has been quite limited. That
yes.
what we normally have is we have a complaint that has been raised by an individual, and we examine the facts based on what was the conduct, whether it was pervasive. And I would contend in my case it is pervasive. I think that there's no dispute that the conduct that Ms. Alegria had to incur was pervasive. So then we look at, in terms of looking at those facts, we look at what knowledge was possessed by the entity or the supervisory officials.
What's your best case authority for us to look beyond your client's situation?
Two cases authored by Justice O'Connor. First, and I would argue to this court that this law has been developmental in nature, because at one point in time,
well, okay, it but did answer the question
sure.
first, and
first
then
we'll
case. Go on to the rest.
G-E-B-S-E-R Gerbster was Justice O'Connor wrote, authored in 1998, and there's language where that information, however, consisted of a complaint from parents and other students charging only that Waldrop had made inappropriate comments during class, which was plainly insufficient to alert the principal of the possibility of Waldrop was involved in sexual relationships with a student at Largo Vista. Moreover, terminated Waldrop's employment. So the first case, in terms of the question that it was insufficient evidence to alert that these comments being made to other students, that this teacher possibly may be engaging in sexual conduct. That case and the language in that case in terms of how the facts were developed gives an indication that one may possibly be able to prove a Title IX case, if one provides sufficient evidence of deliberate and blindness in terms of what's going on in the department.
Before you leave that one, though, correct me if I'm wrong, my recollection is that on the Alanise case, that there is no evidence in this record of it being directly reported to Kelly.
It was reported to a supervisor, and I would contend that that is sufficient. Because what the case law says is...
Well, Kelly is the one who took the action in this case, and who is in charge of the whole thing, right?
Absolutely. But I don't think law...
But you're depending on the Alanise situation for your deliberate blindness or prior knowledge or scienter or whatever you want to call it. And yet there's no evidence that Kelly, who had the authority to do this, even knew of the Alanise case.
But I think that there is sufficient evidence in this record that Sanchez, who was a supervisor in the department, had authority to do something. She had authority to take action. She was his supervisor. She was one of multiple supervisors that he had over the years. And 3 years ago, she was the supervisor for Williams prior to Alegria. In addition, Sanchez could have walked out of her office and said, we have a serious problem, and went to Kelly. And I think that knowledge factor goes to supervisors. And so whether she had told one supervisor or walked into Kelly's office directly, I think that that's sufficient under Title IX.
Well, you were going to give me another case,
yes.
Too, were
yes.
you not?
Yes,
what
Your Honor.
Was that?
Davis, in 1999, where Justice O'Connor wrote the opinion of the case, and there's language where applying the standard of facts at issue here, we conclude that the 11th Circuit erred in dismissing petitioner's complaint. Petitioner alleged that her daughter was the victim of repeated acts of sexual harassment over a 5-month period, and then it goes on, and there are allegations in support of the conclusion that GF's misconduct was severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive. And then the court also talks about that in terms of that there were multiple victims who were disturbed by GF's misconduct to seek the audience of the principal, and the principal did nothing.
Okay, now you say that there's enough here to hold the defendants liable under Title IX.
Yes.
Now, what about the fact that under Title IX, it has to be an education program or activity.
And I know that argument, I don't think, when Congress readdressed it in the Civil Rights Restoration Act, it came in and said, well, we recognize what the court has ruled, but we think Title IX should have greater breadth than this and other activities. And so it is an entity that receives federal funds, not necessarily an educational institution, that if you receive federal funds, you're subject to Title IX and other activities. So someone such as Ms. Alanise, who is a probationer, has the benefit of Title IX not to be sexually harassed.
Okay, but you admit it isn't an education program or activity. You're relying on something else.
I'm relying on Title IX. I read Title IX in the Civil Rights Restoration Act, that it went in and grabbed, Congress went in and said, we respectfully disagree with the Supreme Court, and we view the law to be more expansive than this.
And so did this occur after the enactment of the Civil Rights Restoration?
Yes, it did, Your Honor. I see that I have 30 seconds now. I'm going to sit down and reserve that 30 seconds for rebuttal.
Fine. That's fine, Mr. Griffin. Ms. Kane.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. I'd like to address the last point regarding Title IX first. The amendment that Mr. Griffin talks about, served to amend, it's my understanding, 20 U.S.C. 1687, which defined program or activity for purposes of Title IX. It left in place 20 U.S.C. 1681, subsection A, which continues to provide to this day that Title IX is only actionable in the context of education programs or activities. So the admission by the appellant that there is no education program or activity here should be dispositive on the Title IX claim. That does leave a Section 1983 claim that was made against Mr. Kelly, and which I would like to address in reference to the facts of this case. Now, Mr. Kelly was a supervisor of, the director of the Galveston County Community Supervision and Corrections Department, or the Adult Probation Department. In this case, as to Mr. Williams was an 11-year employee of the department under the supervision of Mr. Kelly that entire time. It is undisputed in this record that Mr. Kelly had no notice prior to the incidents at issue in this case that Mr. Williams had ever acted in an inappropriate manner to any probationer, any employee of the department. He had never heard a rumor regarding Mr. Williams. He had never personally observed any untoward behavior of Mr. Williams towards anybody in the office. It is clear under Section 1983 supervisor liability law that in order to impose liability on a supervisor for failure to train or supervise, there must be evidence of a past pattern of similar behavior by the subordinate that would give rise to an inference by the supervisor that this supervisee would be likely and obviously likely to commit a constitutional violation if the supervisor did not intervene and provide additional training or supervision. There is no such evidence in this case as to Mr. Williams. There is evidence, and just to address a couple of the issues, you're correct, Judge Wiener, that as to Ms. Alanis's allegations, those did not come to light until after the incidents at issue in this case. They came to light in February 2006. This incident happened starting in October 2005 through January 2006. There was another incident brought to Mr. Kelly's attention regarding Mr. Williams at the end of January 2006 involving another probationer, but again, that was following the incident at issue here. Moreover, supervisor liability in the deliberate indifference standard requires both actual notice on the part of the supervisor and then a failure to react reasonably. And here, as Justice O'Connor made clear, Mr. Williams was immediately reprimanded and brought into the disciplinary process once Mr. Kelly received notice of the violations against Ms. Allegria in this case, at which point he resigned. He's no longer with the department. Ms. Allegria testified in her deposition that she has not had any other problems with any other probation officers in the department since this incident.
Give me a status. What is the status of the case against Williams? Is that gone?
We never appeared on behalf of Mr. Williams in his individual capacity. So as to those claims, I cannot speak, but as
no idea what happened to that case? Well, in
the criminal matter against Mr. Williams?
Anything.
It's outside of the record, but Mr. Williams was, it is my understanding, brought up on charges of official oppression and lewd conduct and found guilty, sentenced to jail time and community supervision as a result of that.
But on this Title IX and Section 1983 case, I got the impression the appeal is being pursued primarily against Kelly and the government. But is it still active against, and maybe I should ask counsel absent, against Williams, or you just don't know?
As to his individual capacity claims, we never appeared. As to the official capacity claims, we did appear on behalf of Mr. Williams.
Because that's against the state.
Exactly, and Mr. Kelly. And we would note that in the lower court, the official capacity claims for prospective injunctive relief were expressly abandoned by the appellant. There was some allusion to declaratory relief that was being sought, but there's nothing in the briefing to this court that indicates that those claims are still being maintained here.
Okay.
So the only claim before us is his Title IX claim.
And also the 1983?
There was a 1983 claim that was dismissed on the basis of qualified immunity against Mr. Kelly in the lower court. In this court, the appellant prefaces the 1983 argument by noting that he's just bringing claims against Williams in his individual capacity and the official capacity claims. He appears to expressly abandon the individual capacity claim against Mr. Kelly. Nevertheless, there is arguments contained within the brief related to qualified immunity that seem to allude that the claim is still being maintained here, so we, you know, are responding to that.
Well, doesn't Pennhurst take care of 1983 as far as official capacity is concerned?
Yes, in terms of any monetary damages sought against the official capacity defendants or against the state directly, which were dismissed early on in the litigation, those would be barred. If the panel has no further questions, we would request that the court affirm the judgment of the lower court.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Kane. We have your argument.
Let me ask you just one thing.
Of course.
Did you argue below that there was no education program or activity?
No, we didn't, Your Honor.
And why not?
I was not participating in the litigation at that point, so I'm not sure why a motion.
So it could have been a negligent omission.
In terms of?
Of making that argument.
What ideally should have happened is that some sort of 12B motion, failure to state a claim, should have been filed to have the claim dismissed. Mm-hmm. But for purposes of the appeal here.
Well, there are a lot of cases saying a state waives its sovereign immunity defense if it doesn't present it.
We would say that beyond the state or its institutions, state institutions do not have 11th Amendment immunity, at least in this circuit, for Title IX claims anyway. So the issue here is that there's really no Title IX claim that was ever pled. But because of the mere fact that there was no allegation made in the complaints, the pleadings, or the briefing here, that there was an education component. So to the extent, if there was a viable Title IX claim here, then the question of immunity would actually be a non-issue because it would be waived. But because there is no viable or cognizable Title IX claim here, we would say that our immunity remains intact because the only viable claim would be Section 1983.
So there was no Rule 12 motion filed in this action to sort of flesh that out?
No, and so the district court undertook a very exhaustive analysis as to the merits of the Title IX claim. And we would also note, as we did in our brief, if the court were to reach the merits of the Title IX claim, it does require a showing of deliberate indifference on a part of a supervisory official, as Justice O'Connor wrote in Gebser and Davis. And here, the record demonstrates that Kelly, in this matter, is the director of the department and the person with the authority to discipline and is the person that has to have all matters reported to him when sexual harassment is at issue.
And I gather you agree that Article 11 sovereign immunity is not an issue now?
In terms of the Title IX claim?
Either.
No, because any claims, except for...
you've got sovereign immunity and Pennhurst taking care of 1983.
Yes.
And you waived it in Title IX.
Yes.
So we don't have to bother with that.
No. The only immunity that would really be at issue here would be as to Mr. Kelly in his individual capacity. Mr. Kelly in his individual capacity,
yeah.
As to qualified immunity, which is how those claims were disposed of against
and
him
that,
in the lower
that
court.
That would have taken deliberate indifference.
Yes. They looked at whether under his actions were objectively reasonable under
yeah.
the clearly established law based on the deliberate indifference law at that time.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Griffin, you have about 5 minutes if you'd like.
Thank you. I have a minute. In our reply brief, and if I can track the court just briefly through procedurally where we are in this case, the first district court opinion was rendered on September 2007. And before the court at that time was defendant's Kelly motion for summary judgment based on qualified immunity. And that's at page 499 of the record. And defendants Larry Williams and Ellie Kelly's in their official capacity and the state of Texas motion for summary judgment. The court granted Kelly's individual capacity and left for another day, denied against the state of Texas, Williams, and Kelly in their official capacity, and then said that it will please plaintiff tell me why I should not sui sponde dismiss or grant summary judgment on all claims except 1983. We were then required to respond, and we did respond. In October 2007, the court issued another opinion. And in that opinion, the court was sui sponte grant summary judgment on the Title IX claim alleged against Williams in their individual capacity and the Title IX and 1983 claims alleged against the state of Texas and Williams in their official capacity, and then leaving 1983 as the only thing left when Williams in his individual capacity. So after this November ruling, November 2007 ruling, and found at 683 of the record and under tab 6 of our appellate excerpts, the only thing left at that point was individual capacity against Williams. And then we then went out and took the deposition of Alanese. And the court, in its opinion, memorandum opinion, on March of 2008, found on our record excerpt attachment 7 at 780, then ruled on Alanese by saying, well, this is comparative to motion for new trial, even though there were still matters pending and we did not have a final judgment, and then said, if I'm going to consider Alanese, I'm not going to consider it in that context because the Supreme Court hasn't answered that question. That's how we got here. And then when we appealed up, we only appealed, and the court also denied our request for default judgment against Mr. Williams on the individual capacity, saying that the third amended complaint had not been served on Williams on the individual capacity, therefore Mr. Williams' case disappeared individually. And when we appealed up, we appealed only against Kelly and Williams in their official capacity, the state of Texas as the governing entity, and we did not bring individual claims against Kelly, nor did we, if I'm not mistaken, against Mr. Williams. There is no claim in this matter against Williams, if I'm not mistaken, because, and that's what I was looking for when I stood up. Correct. This court should reverse the judgment. It says the district court's final judgment should reverse and the state of Texas and the individual defendants Williams and Kelly in their official capacities. So what's before this court is only Williams and Kelly in their official capacity and the state of Texas as the entity. I recognize and I try to be quite clear in our briefing, telling the court that this question has not been answered. I have watched the development of Title IX and have brought Title IX cases in the past, and the court has not addressed the full extent of how that law should be interpreted. Congress has expressed a concern, and in our reply brief on page 5, footnote 3, when the Supreme Court in Grove City viewed program activity narrowly, Congress came back and redefined it and said, for purposes of this act, the terms program or activity and program means all the operations of a department, agency, special purpose district, or other instrumentality of a state or a local government. And then it says semicolon or. And
well, so now that only goes to the issue of sovereign immunity, right? Because whether it's educational or not?
Yes.
And we've already heard the state say they have waived that, so okay. We don't need to worry.
Okay.
In fact, it would be dicta if we ruled on that.
Okay. And let me see if I can do this in the last 20 seconds then. All right. On page 16.
How about we give you a minute?
Okay. And I think I can do it. Page 16, 17, and 18 of our brief, we try to set out for the court all the things why this case should be contextually different than the normal Title IX case. The state of Texas had created an environment that for women in that department, they were prey. And by prey, I mean that the activity was going on and about, and Kelly, the director of the department, did everything he could to keep Judge Chris at bay. I think it is extraordinary for a state district judge who's an elected official to come to those board meetings and to repeatedly complain over and over and over again, if you don't stop this activity, you're putting our probationers at risk. And She did everything she could from giving her deposition to filing complaints, and lo and behold, Mrs. Alegria's attack took place. We ask the court, with due respect, to answer the question, the full extent of Title IX should also extend that when you create an environment of deliberate indifference, governmental entities can be found liable in this matter. I thank the court for the pleasure and the honor of arguing before this court.
Thank you. We have your argument. The case, like the other cases, will be under submission, and the court will stand.